basically to give them an excuse to have to defend themselves in a way. So those are some of the tactics of the repressive response. And there are also many leaders of the organization were driven into exile.
Right.
Eldridge Cleaver, who was one of the who was the Minister of Communication for the party, was driven into exile in Algeria. Other people fled to Cuba. People fled to different sort of progressive and revolutionary countries in the world at that time. I'll talk about the Algerian connection a bit more when I talk about the Panthers on the world stage, because that's very, very interesting in itself. But the fact that leaders of the organization had to flee the country was another symptom of the really, really enormous and brutal campaign of repression that the American state unleashed on the Black Panther Party, because they did understand them as a revolutionary threat.
Yeah, straight up.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. So basically, well, yeah, like let's get in a little bit on the international connections
sure.
that the Black Panther Party's had, because I mean, you said it was in Cuba, it was in Algeria. I know Huey Newton went to China at one point, you know, and North Korea, there was even a connection
yeah.
there. So maybe you could get into elaborating on some of that.
Sure. Well, again, this is what I would describe as another area where Malcolm X articulated an idea and then the Panthers tried to put it into practice. And so there's this idea floating around in the African-American movement and in the radical movements of the time of third world internationalism, that all the colonized and oppressed peoples of the world should, you know, should unite and were uniting against global white supremacy and imperialism. And the Black Panthers carried that out, and they established political connections with anti-imperialist regimes and increasingly with socialist countries in the third world. So yes, they did go to China. Members of the Black Panther Party went to China. They established connections with China, and Huey Newton came back from China absolutely thrilled with what he had seen. This was around 1970, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely thrilled with what he had seen, and the things that he said about China echoed what an earlier generation of African-American revolutionaries had said about the USSR in the 1930s and 40s and 50s, which is that he said that when he went to China, he felt like a human being. That he felt like a human being in a profound way that white racist society in the United States had never for a moment allowed him to feel, which is a lot like what Paul Robeson and Langston Hughes said about the Soviet Union when they went. So there's the Chinese connection there. And the Panthers also promoted, to an extent, the image and the ideas of Mao Zedong. And they it started just with the Panthers making a bit of money by selling copies of The Little Red Book to white leftists. So that was the birth of the connection. But Mao did, and eventually the leadership took up Mao as an intellectual influence. And they started using Mao in political education in the party. Fred Hampton in Chicago was a sort of one of the more communist-oriented Panthers, and he made sure that that Mao was used in their political education program in the Chicago branch. So there's the Chinese connection. They also had a connection with Cuba. Members of the party went to Cuba for diplomatic reasons. They met representatives of North Vietnam and the National Liberation Front of South Vietnam in Cuba. And they also, some Panthers and other black revolutionaries at the time, also went into exile in Cuba. And they also, again, established a connection with Vietnam, as I just mentioned. I can't remember who it was, but one of the leaders of the party suggested to the North Vietnamese that they send a black international brigade, effectively, to fight the U.S. Army alongside the Vietnamese. And that was politely rejected. But the North Vietnamese government and the liberation forces in South Vietnam were very, very appreciative of all the efforts that the Black Panther Party went to promote solidarity with the Vietnamese struggle in the United States, which they did a lot of work on that. And and Algeria. As I mentioned, some Panthers went into exile in Algeria. And Algeria was a country that a lot of people on the radical left in the world and a lot of people involved in national liberation struggles had a lot of hope for at this point in history. Algeria, of course, had become independent in 1962 at the end of a very long, extraordinarily hard-fought struggle for independence against the French.
Mm-hmm.
And the political posture that the new leadership in Algeria, in independent Algeria, struck in the 1960s and 70s was one of militant anti-imperialism and solidarity with all national liberation movements in the world that were still fighting their own struggles. Algeria provided support to liberation struggles in sub-Saharan Africa that were still going on, struggles in the Arab world, including and especially the Palestinian struggle, and they also established this connection with the African-American movement. And for a time, Algeria did not have diplomatic relations with the government of the United States, but they did have diplomatic relations to the point of there being an embassy with in Algiers with the Black Panther Party. So the Black Panther Party effectively, as far as the Algerian government was concerned, was kind of the government of exile of America. And certain members of the leadership of the party did speak of the Panthers as a government in exile, at least for Black America and possibly for all of America at times. There's a clip in the Black Power mixtape where Eldridge Cleaver, in exile in Algeria, effectively expresses that idea. And that can sound a bit grandiose, but when you think about it concretely, they had more of a claim to being legitimate representatives of the African-American population than the white racist American state does. So there was a bit of...
It's true.
There was a bit of substance to that, even if there was also rhetoric in it as well. And yes, they also did establish a connection with North Korea. And I don't know too much about the details of that, but I do know... I mean, I've seen a copy of the... or a cover of the Black Panther newspaper with Kim Il-sung's image on it. So to an extent, they did the same thing that they did with Mao, in that they saw him as... they saw Kim Il-sung, and they saw the Korean Revolution as an example of a colonized country that had fought and liberated itself from imperialism. And especially as the Panthers became more oriented towards socialism, they became more influenced by, you know, by socialist countries. But it was mostly specifically socialist countries of the third world, like Vietnam, Cuba, Korea, and China.
Mm. Yeah, and so these are, of course, the countries that are standing in solidarity with the Panthers in their struggle, and, of course, they've, you know, developed these kind of international connections. It's really quite extraordinary, like, how in-depth some of these connections became. But even in the United States, you could say there was kind of some... almost, you could say, internationalist kind of connections in terms of them influencing other organizations, say, like in, like, Hispanic groups are fighting for, fighting against injustice, you know, perpetrated by the state against their own communities, and even white organizations that you could say are, like, standing up to the to the state in America.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe you could mention some of those. This is a history that not many people know about, right?
That's true, and that's unfortunate. This is probably one of the most important, I would say, one of the most important aspects of the impact that the Black Panther Party had. And it is correct to say internationalism, at least in terms of the understanding that they would have had of the situation at the time.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, as you mentioned, there were organizations inspired by the Black Panther Party in a variety of different communities. This is something that basically starts happening in 1968, I would say. And a good place to start looking at it is in Chicago,
mm-hmm.
with the influence of Fred Hampton as an individual. It sounds like we're talking about Fred Hampton a lot, but he was really, really extraordinary.
Well,
so
yeah,
we're going to.
It's true.
So Fred Hampton, one of the aspects of the Panthers' work in Chicago was politicizing street gangs. And at first, that was black street gangs. And the Panthers were successful in some areas in doing that, in showing the young black men who were in these gangs that the reason that they were in the situation that they were in, and that they had to turn to the path that they had in their lives, was because of capitalism and white supremacy. And they were able to start politicizing these people. And that had an impact in Chicago's Puerto Rican community, where a man named Jose Jimenez was influenced by Hampton to do the same thing with the gang that he led, and that created an organization called the Young Lords. And the Young Lords took up the kind of community service, serve the people programs that the Black Panthers were running in the black community in Chicago and in cities across the United States. Haven't really been talking about that, but you know, it's an important aspect of the Black Panthers and what they did. And so Jimenez and the Young Lords took that up in the Puerto Rican community. There have been large Puerto Rican communities formed in the United States from the late 1940s, in the continental United States from the late 1940s onward, with sort of the collapse of the agricultural economy in Puerto Rico. People had no choice but to move to the mainland, to the colonizing country, in order to make a living, and large communities develop in New York especially, but also in other cities in the Northeast and the Great Lakes. And the Young Lords as an organization begin to spread into those other communities. They start in Chicago, but then Puerto Rican student activists in New York who are in Chicago for a meeting of Students for a Democratic Society learn about the Young Lords. And they realize that they can take radical politics off campus and into the Puerto Rican community. And circles of politicized and radicalized Puerto Rican youth start to develop in New York, and they come together to create another Young Lords organization, which then spreads to Boston and New Jersey and a number of large Puerto Rican communities on the East Coast. And they took up the kind of politics that the Panthers did, which was to start from the basic material needs of the community. And the basic material needs of the community and the basic material situation of the community was very, very similar to that of the African-American population. You had mass unemployment and low-wage work, crowded, unhealthy housing, poor health conditions, you know, hospitals that didn't really serve the people, especially for the Puerto Rican community. It was very, very difficult for people to get health care in Spanish, especially you know, even in New York, where there were millions of Spanish-speaking people, and police brutality and murder of Puerto Rican youth, that was also a problem. So the Young Lords did things like in New York, they organized, because garbage wasn't being picked up in the Puerto Rican community, they organized a mass gathering of garbage and then burned it in the center of the street and created a barricade. And they forced the city through that to start picking up garbage. And they started organizing along with a coalition of other organizations, most of which I think I'll get the opportunity to talk about, for a new hospital to be built on the Lower East Side in the poorest area, or one of the poorest areas in New York, that would serve the interests of the people, where people would be able to get quality medical service, decent working conditions for medical workers, service in their native languages for Spanish and Chinese-speaking immigrants. So the Young Lords are a very, very good example of an organization that was influenced by the Panthers, both in terms of directly where they came from and in terms of trying to take up the same kind of politics to deal with the issues that existed for their people. And organizations like this developed in every racially or nationally oppressed community in the United States. In the Southwest, you have Chicano youth creating organizations like the Brown Berets, that attempted to do the same thing. Again, in a remarkably similar situation, of course, you have the Chicano people suffering horrific national oppression for 150 years since the occupation of the Southwest by the United States, and the same kind of politics is taken up. And in the Asian American community, where many of the issues are similar, but there are also some differences. Incidentally, this is when Asian American is actually coined as a term. It was created
at this time.
It was created to create political unity between Chinese and Japanese and Filipino Americans, basically, and the other East and South Asian communities that existed in the United States, and to replace the racist term Oriental. But in any case, in New York, Chinese American youth created an organization called Ai Wor Kwen, which was named after a revolutionary nationalist organization in China in the early 20th century, and that, again, tried to take revolutionary politics to the Chinese community, to New York's Chinatown, where people were struggling over housing. Many established Asian communities in the United States were being displaced at this point by urban development. So there was a struggle for people to be able to stay in their homes and for real redevelopment in those communities that wouldn't drive people out but would actually give people jobs and enable people to stay where they were living in a coherent sort of ethnic cultural community where people wanted to live. So that was one of the fronts of struggle for the Asian organizations that took this up. There was another organization of Chinese and Japanese American youth in San Francisco called the Red Guard Party that was, as you can probably tell by its name, also influenced by China, as was Aiwer Quen in New York. They were influenced by the Chinese Revolution and the Cultural Revolution going on in China. But they were also very, very immediately influenced by the Black Panthers. And again, it's a very, very similar story in that they took up the demands and the needs of their people in this very, very immediate way, but tried to relate revolutionary politics to those things. And of course, being in San Francisco, they had a very, very close, materially close relationship with the central leadership mm-hmm. of the Black Panther Party mm-hmm. in Oakland. And there was also – there was another organization, a Latino organization, which I would call it that because it wasn't just member – they weren't just Puerto Rican. They weren't just Chicano. There were Puerto Ricans and Chicanos and Central American immigrants involved called the Los Siete organization. And that developed out of a situation where a group of Latino activists, young Latino activists, seven of them, were being framed for the murder of a couple of police officers. And an organization developed that was originally basically just the Los Siete defense campaign – but then developed into a wider organization to serve the impoverished and oppressed Latino community in a neighborhood called the Mission District in San Francisco. And they established ties with the Red Guard Party and with the Black Panthers in Oakland. And this was definitely conceived of as internationalism because, again, the framework, the ideological framework that these people were adopting at this time, the young activists were adopting at this time, was based on a firm rejection of the idea that their communities were minorities mm-hmm. in American society, that they were American minorities, Mexican Americans or what have you, and based on an understanding of their communities as nations, as colonized, oppressed nations within the United States. It was slightly different with the Asian American communities who had a somewhat different historical experience in terms of immigration, but in general, They all saw themselves as being intimately connected to the surge of third world national liberation struggles and of having a deep, deep commonality of interest in overturning white supremacist capitalism in the United States. And the American Indian movement also developed at the same time yeah. among initially young Native Americans in the cities in the Midwest, but also spreading across the country. And their ideology was had a different, to some extent, a different set of influences, influenced by sort of a revival of indigenous traditionalism in a lot of ways. But they also did echo the third world internationalist ideology of the Black that was being put forward by the Black mm-hmm. Panthers and these other organizations to an extent. So again, there are variations dealing with the specific histories and deriving from the specific histories of all of these oppressed people, but ultimately they were united by a common framework that the Panthers had developed and popularized. And that might not seem so remarkable. It is, but it might not seem that way given that all of these groups of people suffer from racial oppression in North American society. But then there was another set of organizations that was influenced by the Black Panther Party that as you said, many people are surprised to learn ever existed because they were organizations made up of white people. And I've already mentioned one group of white people that was influenced by the Black Panther Party, and that was Students for a Democratic Society. But Students for a Democratic Society had a particular demographics, a particular social character, in that it was made up of university students, and it was mm-hmm. made up in the majority of young white people from middle-class backgrounds. Working class people were going to university in the United States in larger numbers than they ever had before at this time. But at least the founders and the people who set the character of SDS were mostly middle class people. But towards the end of the 1960s, some young white activists who were from working class backgrounds began to wonder if they wouldn't be able to organize in their own communities. And this was also a demand that was being put to them by the black movement, mm-hmm. not so much specifically by the Black Panther Party, although the Black Panther Party did play a role in it. But one important development that happened in the late 1960s was that the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, which had been the main organization of black youth in the United States in the early 1960s, took a nationalist turn people like Stokely Carmichael became more and more influenced by African nationalism, by Pan-Africanism. And a decision was made that white activists would no longer be allowed to work in the organization. And they were told to go organize their own people. And most of the white activists who were involved, some of them were, you know, they were hurt, but they accepted the political rationale. They accepted, you know, the fact that they needed to take direction from the black movement on this. And they did start to take up the task of organizing their communities. Of course, one of the features of the situation is that the situation in North America in the late 1960s is that there's a real climate of militancy and mass mobilization among people of color, especially the black community, but not just the black community, in all these other oppressed nationality communities that we've been talking about. But there was much less of that going on among the broad majority of white Americans outside of the campus environment. But there was a very significant effort made to change that. And so you have organizations sprouting up in white working class communities in Brooklyn, in Chicago, in Philadelphia, in Boston, in Vancouver. There was an organization in Vancouver that tried to carry out the politics of the Black Panther style sort of community organizing. It was called the Partisan Party. And some of these organizations, it's funny, they had names that you would not imagine a leftist organization having. There was an organization in Brooklyn called White Lightning, which sounds like a racist organization, but it was a militant anti-racist organization that was taking up this task of organizing white people. And that meant two things. That meant attempting to convince poor and working-class white Americans that they should support the black liberation movement. But it also meant organizing these communities around their own needs. And there were particular situations that were sort of very, very close in some ways to the situation that had produced the Black Panther Party. In the 1940s and 50s and 60s, there was a huge migration of poor white people from Appalachia into the industrial sort of Northwest and Great Lakes area. And they ended up concentrated together in communities with high unemployment and low incomes and terrible housing, and young people in those communities were dealing with police harassment as well. So there was an organization that developed in this Appalachian community in Chicago called the Young Patriots. Again, Fred Hampton. Fred Hampton was able to create an alliance between the Black Panthers, the Young Patriots, the Young Lords. I believe there may have been a Chinese organization in Chicago involved as well, a Chinese-American organization. And this was called the Rainbow Coalition, which, of course, would be sort of the name 20 or so years later, adopted by the Jesse Jackson campaign in a very, very different set of political circumstances. But this was the first Rainbow Coalition, and it's probably the clearest example of the internal internationalism, you could say, of the Black Panther Party. And I think Fred Hampton expressed this most articulately and most clearly, but it came from all the major leaders of the Black Panther Party, was that they really deeply believed that they were not simply participating in and dealing with a struggle of black people against racist oppression. What they were dealing with was a struggle of all oppressed and colonized nations and all oppressed and exploited people in North America, in the United States, in North America, and in the world against a system defined by racism, but also by capitalism.
Mm-hmm.
And so they believe that even if at first, you know, many white workers were hesitant or poor white people were hesitant to support the black liberation movement, that ultimately this alliance could be created because all oppressed and exploited people had common interests. And that's also one of the crucial contributions that the Black Panther Party made.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, this is something we are definitely not told about. I mean, the idea that the white supporters of the Black Panther Party, who actually made a real effort,
yeah,
like organizing effort in their own communities to organize, like, effectively white people against the very colonial structure, racist colonial structure, yeah, that had, you know, supposedly empowered them, but at the same time, you know, supposedly elevated them over African-Americans and, like, indigenous people and this sort of thing, but basically were also using them and exploiting them and basically treating them as, you know, weapons to be used, tools, mm-hmm, you know, basically being used and turning them almost into little monsters, which they effectively were refusing to be a part of, which is pretty profound. I think that has lessons for us right now.
Absolutely. You know?
But thank you very much for coming on and talking to us about this, because, I mean, this is absolutely... This conversation has been amazing.
It's my pleasure.
You know, your insight into this, like, you brought a lot of knowledge here. And I'm amazed you managed to remember all that. I mean, you can't see this. People are actually listening in, but Brendan is sitting here. He has no notes in front of him. He's basically just, you know, you did a lot of preparation, obviously.
I tried.
But at the same time, like, this is all coming from your head, right? This is just communicating, which is absolutely amazing. So, once again, comrade, I want to thank you again for contributing here on this show.
Thanks
a lot.
It's great
to be here.
Always great to be here. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So we're going to take a short break here. I'm back in the USSR, and we're going to be back after a few minutes. So please stay tuned.
You are listening to CFRU Radio, 93.3 FM in Guelph, Ontario, and available worldwide at cfru.ca. This is a rebroadcast of the program Back in the USSR. This was originally broadcast on February the 28th, 2015.
So read the Communist Manifesto, gorillas in the mix, the Guevara and Manesto. So
what a brother with an afro now.
Yo, know a flow for the Mac, and we the hoes. So grow, cause the Lucian brothers might get hung. Rhetoric flowing from the tip of my mouth, say tongue deficit.
Money spent,
the glint
on my nine as they cut welfare 25%.
And I dissent as I clinch and raise my
fist. We did away with that,
so you could get with this. It's a twist, cause we're overthrow like Kwame Nkrumah. Spread around the world as if it were a business rumor. Bam, cuts a record like a surgeon cuts a tumor from a brain.
We're all duped up, so feel the pain.
From 400 years of exploitation, anesthesia provided by your local TV station. Patience is not a virtue.
I ain't waiting.
Turn the shit over like Bush did a boatload of hate. In a dog pound like H-Rap Brown with the situation.
Won't be no calluses,
cause we're spitting dialectical analysis. So how is this we never had no funk? Until you found out that our trunks are revolutionary, huh?
Chuck,
bump you over like dominoes, rat.
So free Geronimo, you jack a prick.
Lyrics, hear it, lyric, can't get near it. Got a sample, didn't clear it. Point blank says, fuck 5-0, that's the spirit. Cheer it. Spat out the fact that I consumed, knew that I was doomed since my date of birth to be the wretched of the earth. Never had a dream that was American.
They voted like the Cherokee.
Disparaging.
But that ain't nothing new.
Told the streets where paper go, whoever paid that shit got minimum wage too. Exploited and they hung us. I'd like to take a moment to say fuck Columbus.
Millions off my back.
The black on black crisis is a myth. The crack that did the
damage.
What's
the one from the whip?
The record skip. The record skip. The record skip. The record skips, cause my voice is kinda scratchy from yelling, don't you, and 5-0 comes to harass me.
They never pass me, no one to go and tell, bro.
Try to kill the movement with a new COINTEL, bro.
Leaders they kill, if I said it, it was granted them. They only see my back because I'm 3 steps ahead of them. We're not falling in the slot, just slated.
We realize that our power is nigga plated.
Masses move as well as asses do. Class is through, our time is over, past is due.
And you still wanna know
the origin of the flow. Oakland, California, now for 6-1 up.
Yeah,
the
coup coming at you in
90 degrees.
Yeah, and we out, y'all.
Do you understand the metaphoric phrase? Do you understand the metaphoric phrase? Do you understand the metaphoric phrase? Do you understand? Do you understand?
It's the paradigm of the wagon train versus the swarthy hordes. First enunciated very well by in a marvelous article by Tom Engelhardt in the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists. It could be happening in the American Wild West. It could be in the Amazon jungle, the North African desert, the Sudan, the Transvaal, the South Pacific jungles, or Indochina. The scene is generally the same. There's a fort, or an encampment, or a wagon train. And inside that encampment are the human beings. They're white. They're human. They're warm, they're attractive, they talk, and they're nice. Outside come the swarthy hordes, the savages. They can be Indians, they can be Bushmen, they can be Arabs on camels and horses or whatever else. And they are the subhumans, and they are attacking the human beings. And the wagons form their circle. And the human beings know what to do. They level their guns and they begin to knock off, shoot, and kill these screaming savages who attack them. Why do the swarthy hordes attack the white people? You don't know. They never tell you. Is it to protect their lands? Is it to protect their herds? Is it to protect their villages and their towns and their families and their children? No, it's just because they like to do that. That's their thing. They like to attack. And so they have to be killed. And by the way, it's not even bravery that they manifest. As they charge in great numbers and get cut down in horrible numbers, this is not even bravery. Although similar acts by whites would be portrayed as heroic. This itself is portrayed as a manifestation of the swarthy hordes, their fanatic, crazed way of wanting to bloodlust. Now the trouble with this paradigm... The trouble with this paradigm is that it turns the history of the last 400 years on its head. That it reverses the roles of usurper and usurped. It reverses the roles of victim and victimizer. It reverses the roles of those who were massacred and those who were doing the massacring. It was the European and North American civilizers, so-called, who went in there and destroyed the villages and destroyed their industries and destroyed their townships. Read Engels on North Africa, what happened to the Arabs and Berbers, and when he goes in and describes the beautiful towns with the fine, hard stone and plaster buildings and their woolen industries and their mining industries and their arts and crafts and all that. And then read the description of the French troops coming in and systematically destroying it and killing every man, woman, and child. Read about how the Germans went into South Africa and killed the Herero tribe. 80,000 people, they killed 60,000 of them, and the other 20,000 they used as slave labor in their minds. Read Mark Twain's angry, raging comments about King Leopold of Belgium, calling him a mad dog and what he did to the innocent, unoffending people of the Congo, taking them and enslaving them, 1 million of them a year dying in the mines in the Congo. That's what the history's about. That's what John Wayne is about. And what these films do is they reverse that history, stand it on its head. They do what Joseph Goebbels said. They give you a big lie, and they embellish it, and they make you root for the guys in the wagon train.
Yeah, you're listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. And, of course, that was Michael Parenti talking about... basically, he's talking about imperialism as propaganda, as ideology in that clip that we just heard. And really, effectively what we were talking about here tonight, like with the African-American struggle for liberation, like these oppressed nations within North America were fighting back and like kind of, you know, adopting internationalist tactics, not only with countries outside the United States and peoples and liberation struggles outside the United States and North America, but also within it. And that is very, very huge. And that is also something that I think speaks to people of European descent as well, or it should speak to us, you know, because, of course, what is our role in the settler colonial state? Effectively, we are the ones who are supposed to beat down these other peoples. We're the ones who are supposed to do the oppressing in the name of the elite, you know, in the name of the capitalists and the imperialists who really drive this system and are enriched by it. We are effectively supposed to be their tools, you know, their weapons. And this is effectively the role that we must reject. We must reject this role, this imperialist role, this colonizing role. And we ourselves must become internationalists. You know, it's a very complicated thing for us because, of course, in many cases, as people of European descent, we are not encouraged to remember our own history, our own past involvement in liberation struggles, whether that was in North America or whether it was back in Europe, whether it was like part of, say, the Irish anti-imperialist struggle against the British Empire, or if it was like anti-imperialist, struggles in Eastern Europe or wherever, you know, or class struggles or what have you. You know, we're not encouraged to remember who we really are. You know, we're expected to internalize this kind of colonial narrative that normalizes oppression and exploitation of all these different peoples in North America and the taking of their lands and the destruction of their livelihoods and all this sort of thing, and normalizes conquest, you know, and says that we are a part of this kind of system, and that's the way it has to be. That's the way it's portrayed as natural to us. And this is what we must revolt against. This is what we have to mutiny against. And basically see ourselves as one people amongst many, or multiple peoples amongst many for that matter, because of course we're not all the same by any means, even though we're taught to be the same, to see ourselves just as white, to define ourselves by the color of our skin. But of course we come from many, many different backgrounds, Western European, Eastern European, Southern European, Northern European, wherever, you know, we're coming from all kinds of different areas, even just like people, you know, of European descent, let alone people from elsewhere around the world. You know, and we have to remember this. We have to, like, remember, once again, where we came from, the kind of struggles, the class struggles, anti-imperialist struggles that we emerged from. We have to educate ourselves. And if we educate ourselves, we can remove ourselves from that ideological, reactionary ideological framework that we were taught to be a part of, really from a very young age, and ourselves become internationalists and learn to stand in solidarity with the oppressed peoples of the world, and in that way bring down this system that also oppresses us and uses us, and that gets us to be something that we are not. You know, so this is what we really need to remember. I know I've talked about this on the show a number of times, but the whole talk with Brendan here has definitely inspired me to talk about it again. So I'm going to play a few clips just to round things off. This next clip I'm going to play is really speaks to. It's basically by a guy named Gerald Ford. He's an African American historian in the States. He recently wrote a book called "The Counter Revolution of 1776," talking about the reactionary nature, really fundamentally, of the American Revolution, certainly from a racial perspective. And this is his commentary, actually, on the Ferguson situation and Black Lives Matter. So I'm gonna play that. So please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
Welcome back to The Real News Network. I'm Paul Jay in Baltimore. Welcome back to Reality Asserts Itself. We're continuing our series of discussions with Gerald Horn, who now joins us in the studio. Gerald's recent book, The Counter-Revolution of 1776, Slave Resistance and the Origins of the USA, and he's the author of about 30 other books. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
So in the Civil War, as we talked about in the last segment, we touched on, this slave system and the power of the slave owners was getting in the way of this exploding industrial capitalism in the Northeast at all kinds of levels. But it seems that the northern capitalists are in a little bit contradictory position in the sense that this whiteness is pretty good as an ideology, because if you can focus white workers on black workers, it's a good distraction, because the class contradictions were getting pretty fierce at the time with white workers in the North. On the other hand, you got to sell white workers on going to fight in the South, and one of the big stated objectives, at the very least, is the abolition of slavery. So you have abolitionists and others, you know, quite strongly saying, no, these people are humans. So it's somewhat a contradictory message.
Mm-hmm. Well, yes, there are so many contradictions, I don't even know where to start. I mean, first of all, it reminds me of Cuba during the slavery period, where on the one hand, you had this one group of U.S. nationals who were making money hand over fist, going into the Congo River Basin, snatching Africans and bringing them to Cuba to be enslaved, working on plantations often owned by U.S. nationals. Then you had another group of U.S. nationals who were complaining about a process and a term that I guess is fortunate it's disappeared from the language, the English language, which is Africanization. That is to say, they were bringing so many Africans to Cuba, there was a fear that conditions were being created that would allow for another Haiti. That is to say, a slave rebellion, not least because of ratios, that would lead to not only a Haiti on the doorstep of Florida, but another kind of Haiti in the sense of Cuba being on the doorstep of Florida. So that's a contradiction. Then there's contradictions about the capital itself. That is to say that, as noted, there were individuals in Baltimore and in New York and Boston who were profiting quite handsomely from the slave trade. There were other individuals who felt that diverting so much capital into slavery was ultimately inimical to the wider and larger interests of the United States, because it was felt that that capital could be more profitably diverted into manufacturing, for example. And as noted, you had slaves working in manufacturing plants, but that was not seen as optimal given the spinoffs from capitalism, that is to say, workers being able to have multiplier effects by buying clothes, buying foods, buying housing, etc., which from the capitalist point of view is something of a virtuous circle leading to the upward rise of the enterprise. But it's striking to note that even after the 13th Amendment to the United States Constitution was enacted in the 1860s, after the U.S. Civil War, which basically frees the enslaved, after the abolition of slavery with the Emancipation Proclamation, you still have U.S. nationals who are involved in the slave trade, not only to Cuba, where slavery doesn't end until the 1880s, or to Brazil, where slavery doesn't end until the 1880s, but you still have the process of kidnapping. Even after the U.S. Civil War, you have black Americans, U.S. nationals, being kidnapped from the streets of Baltimore. Next thing you know, they're working in the fields of Cuba, or perhaps even in the fields of Brazil. Not only that, but as I stated in an earlier book that I published entitled The White Pacific, you had slave dealers from the United States who, after the U.S. Civil War, migrated to the South Seas and began kidnapping Melanesians and Polynesians and converting them into bonded labor in Queensland, Australia, and in Fiji. And indeed, the then independent Kingdom of Hawaii objects and tries to block this trade, because they're also kidnapping indigenous Hawaiians. And for its pain and troubles, its regime is overthrown by the U.S. in the 1890s, leading to Hawaii becoming a state and the home of the first black president becoming a state in 1959. So this whole area that we're talking about is just replete with contradictions.
Okay, one of the things that came up in the first segment that I promised we'd pick up on, and before we kind of jump to today, this mm-hmm. sort of one another mm-hmm. historical point, is the role of Japan.
Ah, yes, yes.
And in the lead up in World War II, Japan positions itself as the leader of the fight against white supremacy
yes,
in the world.
I confess sheepishly, it's one of my favorite subjects. You know, I did a book some years ago on the Pacific War with that as a centerpiece, and I'm working on another book because I can't get enough of it. To start where I just left off, the Kingdom of Hawaii was trying to broker an alliance with Tokyo, which is probably why you thought of it at this point. That's why so many of the Asian Americans in Honolulu are Japanese American. This was part of a diplomatic alliance, which of course outraged Washington, because they could already see over the horizon to see the Pacific War erupting, scant 40, 50 years later, 1941, 42, that also helps to fuel the overthrow of the Hawaii Kingdom in the 1890s. But it's interesting that Japan, which you may know was something of a hermit kingdom, not unlike how Korea has been described up until the 1850s when the black ships from the United States sail into Japan, and Japan, or at least the Japanese elites, faced the prospect of falling victim to what occurred in neighboring Hong Kong in 1841 when the British had taken over. They were facing the prospect of being colonized. So you have this miraculous turnaround. So by 1868, with the Meiji Restoration, Japan is well on its way to becoming a major industrialized nation and major imperialist nation, as evidenced by its attack on China in the 1890s, which, of course, the Chinese have not forgotten to this very day. But in terms of positioning itself for global leadership, Tokyo felt that it could steal a march in the United States by making these pointed appeals to black Americans. I don't know if they had learned or studied the lessons of other previous antagonists of the United States of America who had also made appeals to black Americans. But in any case, it's quite striking that if you look at black American leadership in the period before World War II, W.E.B. Du Bois, Marcus Garvey, Booker T. Washington, they all had contradictions between and amongst themselves. But to a greater or lesser degree, they were all pro-Tokyo. And many of them visited Japan, such as W.E.B. Du Bois in the 1930s, where he was lionized to a degree. And as I'm going to talk about in this next book that I'm working on, Tokyo had flooded the zone, had sent agents into black American communities beginning in the 1920s. You had all these so-called pro-Tokyo fronts. Indeed, if you look at the history of the organization now known as the Nation of Islam, which of course has a strong base right here in Baltimore, if you look at its origin, it's in many ways it starts off as a pro-Tokyo organization, like so many. It hasn't fallen by the wayside like most of the rest of them. And indeed, this concept that I know you at this enterprise, you're into conscious hip-hop, If you look at this concept of the Asiatic black man, which the Nation of Islam used to tout, and some of the so-called conscious hip-hop elements today in 2014 tout, it comes out of that period of the 1930s when the U.S. Negroes were saying, we're not African, we're Asians. You know, this is part of this pro-Tokyo orientation. And then, of course, if you look at Malcolm X's autobiography, in the middle of the autobiography, he talks about when he's about to be conscripted. He goes to the draft board and talks about how he's pro-Tokyo. What he's expressing is this widespread idea that Japan had helped to seed amongst black Americans, that Japan was the champion of the colored races, that if Japan defeated the United States, the U.S. Negroes would get a better deal. And I argue...
Not unlike Spanish Florida. Going.
Exactly. And I argue in a previous book, and I plan to argue in this next book, that this is part of the momentum that convinces the rulers in the United States that they need to do something about this problem, because it's inimical to national security to have this dispossessed population in great numbers on your shores that could be easily appealed to by foreign antagonists. And so therefore you begin this agonizing retreat from Jim Crow, try to create a black middle class that have a stake in the system, to use that term that was so prevalent not so long ago, and so that they would not be so susceptible to these foreign appeals. And to a degree, that's worked.
How has it worked? Talk about today. How's it worked?
Well, it's worked because you have some. I mean, I'm in Baltimore, so I'm well aware of realities. But you do have a black middle class to a degree that feel they have a stake in the system. You have certain black millionaires, even a few billionaires, who feel they have a stake in the system, less susceptible to the blandishments.
Mostly black city council.
Exactly, which is something new historically in the United States. However, to return to where we began, I think that part of the problem that our leading organization, NAACP, made when they ousted W.E.B. Du Bois in 1948 on Cold War grounds, that is to say that he was perceived as being pro-Moscow and the United States was moving towards anti-communism in a more aggressive fashion, there are many problems with that approach, but one of the problems is that if you look at the great span, the great scope of the history of Africans in North America from the 1600s up until today, I have argued and will continue to argue that there are two constants. Well, actually, one constant and one variable. The constant, which helps to explain progress, is unremitting struggle and resistance, organizing, disciplined organizing. That's the constant. But as your quote suggested, human beings have to make history with the cloth at hand. And that leads to the variable. And the variable, which helps to explain how the constant is going to succeed or not going to succeed, is our ability to lengthen the battlefield, to forge alliances in the international community, to broker international alliances. And so when the NAACP turned aggressively towards anti-communism, they were turning aggressively towards a wholly domestic strategy, relying heavily upon the beneficence of U.S. elites, the U.S. Supreme Court, the Congress, etc. But that has not been the warp and woof of our history. The warp and woof of our history is not just relying upon those domestic forces, but relying on international forces. And that's the major weakness, I would argue, of the black struggle today, is sort of not only not relying upon these global forces, but a kind of myopia, and not even keeping up with these sorts of struggles. We know that in the U.S. Congress, as we speak, there have been all these votes taken in favor of the Israeli aggression against Gaza. So I won't single out the Congressional Black Caucus or black elected representatives, because they share a lot of company in terms of not being heroic and speaking out. But certainly, I think it is not unfair to suggest that black Americans, above all, should be speaking out against this kind of aggression, because our history has suggested to us that when there's that kind of injustice abroad, it inevitably strengthens our opponents here at home to our detriment. So it's in our self-interest, not just as an act of morality or an act of benevolence, to speak out against these kinds of international outrages. But alas, many of our elected representatives are not, and I think we're suffering the consequences.
This emergence after the civil rights movement, and you, as you talked about the various reasons for why it was in the interest of American elites to make these kinds of compromises, but with a great deal of success, a lot of the black elite in the United States has really adopted Americanism. And, you know, President Obama can talk about we're all in the same boat, and talk with nostalgia about 1776 and so on. And that stratum is kind of all there with them.
Well, sure, but the die was cast when the fateful decision was made to throw in our lot wholly and exclusively on the domestic scene, to put all our eggs in that one basket. After you make that decision, well, there's a certain logic that unfolds and flows.
Well, King broke the silence.
Sure.
Certainly his last set of speeches did what you're suggesting should have been done.
Sure.
But he was killed.
Right. And, you know, it's interesting. I've given a number of interviews about the 1776 book, and one interview I gave, this journalist was asking me, do I think that this book should have got more publicity, you know, given his thesis and the research, et cetera? I said, hey, look, in the United States, I'm happy to awake every morning without facing indictment or a murder plot against me. So, I mean, and I say that jokingly, but in a sense, what it bespeaks is a sort of atmosphere in this country where you know that if you step out of line, you're going to get slapped down. And getting slapped down is sort of a euphemism.
So we're in Baltimore, and, you know, 68, 69, mm-hmm. there were tanks on the streets here.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I remember that.
There was a real outburst of resistance, mm-hmm. both organized and spontaneous. Not so much now.
Mm-hmm.
We had our grand opening a few weeks ago, and we kind of talked about how in Baltimore there's something like, I don't know, somewhere, it depends on the year, 230, 240, 250 murders every year.
Wow.
Of which last year 11 were white people and everyone else was black.
Wow.
The chronic poverty here, I mean, it's all kind of become a new acceptable norm.
Yeah.
How much does this ability of America to kind of accept mass incarceration rates, accept this third world within the country, how deep is this in the culture and what we've been talking about? How this weighs on people's minds from the past?
Well, a couple points that come to mind. One is that certain analysts are suggesting that black Americans are the most incarcerated and imprisoned population on this small planet. Certainly, we disproportionately populate death row, which is rather chilling to contemplate. Walking over to your studio, I pass by all these buses, Maryland Corrections. I assume that prisoners are being transported into the courthouses.
Yeah, which are all right behind us.
Exactly. Walking over here, I pass the building that carries the name of Clarence Mitchell. The Mitchell family is a prominent family, a black family, in the city of Baltimore. And Clarence Mitchell was a lobbyist for the NAACP for years. One of his close relatives, Perrin Mitchell, was a congressman from black Baltimore for years. Clarence Mitchell was so influential in the U.S. Congress that he was considered to be the 100th senator, so to speak. And yet, as I look back on the NAACP and Clarence Mitchell and even some of the heroic labor of Perrin Mitchell, I have to consider that despite their yeoman duty, to a certain extent, they had missed the boat. Because once again, to reiterate, once the NAACP made that fateful decision to turn away from the international arena, we turned away from one of our most powerful allies and, in a sense, helped to create the setting for the rise of incarceration. I was just in New York the other day, and as you probably know, there was this yet another police killing captured on videotape of a father, Eric Garner, 43 years old. Choked to death with an illegal chokehold. And his last words, captured on videotape, are something of a coda, it seems to me, for black America. In other words, his last words were, "I can't breathe." That's what he was saying as he was choking to death. And as I watched that videotape, it was like this enormous metaphor for the black condition in North America, stretching back centuries. The suffocation, the cry of despair, the cry of horror, "I can't breathe." But I should also say that the fact that so many people have come into the streets to protest against this latest outrage, this latest police killing, should also be seen as part of the coda, part of the metaphor of the black existence in North America.
All right, this is just the beginning. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you.
And thank you for joining us on Reality Asserts Itself on the Real News Network. And just one more time, Gerald's book is The Counter-Revolution of 1776, Slave Resistance and the Origins of the USA. And Gerald said he'll come back, so we'll...
What's up? This is Teaspoon from Delhi to Dublin, and you're listening to CFRU 93.3 FM.
Once again, the Guelph Resource Center for Gender Empowerment and Diversity is hosting a WENDO self-defense workshop for all self-identified women. This course teaches awareness and avoidance, as well as verbal and physical self-defense techniques. Course content and location are survivor-friendly and wheelchair accessible. While usually $150, this course is being offered for only $45, or $35 if you register before April 25th. The course itself is 9:30 to 5 on Saturday and Sunday, May 9th and 10th. Register in person at the UC Info Desk at the University of Guelph or online at wendo.bpt.me. Visit us at Kirkhead in UC 107 and help yourself to a free cup of tea while you're there. Stay fierce, stay bold, stay safe.
Are you drawn to aggressive sounds? Are you subject to violent outbursts of rage? Do you have sudden urges to destroy everything in sight? If so, we have just the thing for you.
Forever Death! Forever Deaf on 93.3 CFRU, Thursday nights at 10 after 10 following the BBC.
Hi, I'm Nikki Dredd, host of The Crooked Beat on CFRU FM 93.3. On Friday, May 8th, join Royal City Records for Reggae in the Royal City at the District Lounge, 10 Wyndham Street North in Guelph, for a night of words and music, sound and poetry, unity and harmony. If you consider yourself a part of the Royal City reggae family, would love to see a unified reggae scene, or if you just love reggae music and culture, this night is for you. We'll feature talks from reggae leaders, artists, and lovers, and of course, we'll dance and vibe to reggae music all night long. One love, one heart, one aim, one destiny. Let's get together and feel all right. That's Reggae in the Royal City at the District Lounge on Friday, May 8th. Doors open at 9 p.m. and the talks start